on radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is Invest Talk, independent thinking, shared success. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Tuesday, March 31st, 2026 edition of Invest Talk. I'm your host, Luke Guerrero, and this is a very special episode we have for you today for no other reason than we are finally through the first quarter of 2026. What a ride it has been, and certainly there will be more market-moving events on the horizon. So we're going to talk about all of that today. We're going to talk about today's market performance. We're going to run down those show topics for you in just a bit. But why don't we dive right in and end the quarter right by starting to answer our first caller question now.
I have a question regarding a company called Star Surgical. Ticker symbol is STAA. I've never heard anybody say anything about it. And I was wondering your take on it. And it just reported a couple of days ago. Just an overall assessment will be fine. Thank you.
Let's take a look at Star Surgical, ticker STAA. Frankly, I have not heard anybody say anything about this name either. So let's take a look together. What they do is they make the Evo implantable lens. It tries to correct vision without touching the eye's natural lens. For them, their biggest market seems to be China. China, in fact, makes up about 32.5% of their revenue. Only about 9% comes from the United States, 18.9% from Japan, and 39% from elsewhere. It is a small, small company, about $949 million with an M dollar market cap, trading at about $18.70 per share as of today. Now, Q4 revenue came in at $57.8 million, up 18% on paper. But that's a bit misleading because revenue outside of China actually fell 2%. And the whole story is really China, where distributors were destocking because of uncertainty around a proposed Alcon acquisition that ultimately fell apart. Now, full year revenue dropped nearly 24%, so it was certainly a rough year. The good news, though, gross margins improved to 76%, adjusted EBITDA nearly broke even, and China inventory is now normalized. Now, we have seen a persistent downtrend since really the middle of 2021 with very little technical strength, very little positive momentum throughout that time sample. Year to date, they're down 19.01%. So it's been a bit of a rough year. Now, management looks like it's currently two interim co-CEOs while the board is searching for a permanent leader. Management has said 2026 may see significant sales increases, but haven't really done anything to quantify what that means. The stock ran up from about the teens to the mid-20s on the thesis of its recovery and that normalization in China, but it's really since given back a bit of those gains, a fair bit of those gains, especially after the announced Q4 miss. The bull case is pretty simple. You got a real product. You got growing myopia, endemic globally. You have China's restocking tailwind, and you have pretty cheap forward-looking revenue. I mean, it looks like their price to sales, it's about 3.8. That's really dirt cheap. And so from my quick look here, I mean, there's a legitimate product in a bit of a messy operational chapter. There could be high upside, but given its size, given its really all over the place growth and its concentration on one geographical market, that means there's high execution risk as well. So I don't really see anything on the horizon that makes me want to buy into this name right now. Certainly, the price momentum is very weak. Thanks for the call. Well, we got a lot of ground to cover in the next 45 minutes or so, including my main focus point, which is about growth versus value stocks, and are we ready for a major reversal? As you all know, technology stocks have really been suffering. They suffered their worst week in nearly a year last week as investors realized that even the most innovative companies, they can't escape the gravitational pull of rising interest rates and associated economic uncertainty. The sell-off kind of forcing investors to reassess these sky-high valuations and growth assumptions that have dominated the market for the better part of the past couple years. So we'll touch on that story. We also will talk about U.S. consumer confidence, surprisingly on the rise, and the latest labor market data. Gold, why it has really had a bit of a sell-off amidst rising conflict, and how foreign central banks have been selling U.S. treasuries. We also have some voice bank calls ready to play, including one on Synchrony Financial, ticker SYF, and RCI Hospitality Holdings. Rick is the ticker for that one, R-I-C-K. As always, we got some questions from the comment section of the InvestTalk YouTube channel, and hopefully, I look forward to some of your calls throughout the show. Well, we're going into a quick break. Please remember, you can call anytime and leave your questions at the InvestTalk voice bank. If you're listening via our live stream or possibly on AM 1220 in the Bay Area, pick up that phone and dial 888-99-CHART. Up next, we'll talk about today's market activity.
When you tell your friends about InvestTalk and they ask you why you listen, let them know there are many reasons, and one is parallel investing from KPP Financial and InvestTalk host Justin Klein. Parallel investing means Justin invests right alongside KPP Financial clients. He makes the same trade for KPP Financial on the same day, at the same price, and the same percentages as KPP clients. There's no front running and no special treatment. In this way, Justin and KPP Financial share the same risks and the same potential for success. Parallel investing aligns the interests of Justin and KPP Financial with those of his clients. Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero are ready to answer your questions about parallel investing. And you can learn more anytime at investtalk.com. Luke Guerrero is here, and he's ready with answers to your finance and investment questions. Call InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART.
888-99-CHART is, of course, the number to ask your question live while we are on air today. But until we get our first live call, rather before we get our first live call, let's talk a little bit about the market, because equities surged in the biggest rally since last May. It was fueled by fresh hopes for an off-ramp in the Iran conflict. The Dow jumped 2.5%. S&P gained nearly 3% on the day. NASDAQ soared 3.8. Russell 2000 rallied 3.4. Mag 7 collectively up over 4.5% on the day. And the catalyst for that was, well, a bit of a shift in tone from multiple directions. You had the president seemingly confirming reports that he is willing to end the military's campaign against Iran, even if the Strait of Hormuz remains largely closed. You have Iran's president, who said Tehran is ready to end the war, but wants guarantees. You have China and Pakistan, who unveiled a five-point plan for Mideast stability. But the Middle East and really geopolitical backdrop, it's still messy. The IRGC threatened U.S. companies in the region, and a third aircraft carrier has been deployed to that area as well. But for the first time in weeks, markets maybe on hope, maybe on a dead cat bounce, who knows, saw a little bit enough daylight to run with it. The tactical setup was, ripe for exactly this kind of move. Positioning had been widely flagged as washed out. Sentiment was deeply negative, and outsized month and quarter end buying added fuel. Recent rate stabilization did help with some repricing of central bank reaction functions, taking the edge off of the hawkish extreme. And a big week of M&A activity also played into the resilient corporate narrative heading into Q1 earnings season. Now, the leadership textbook, the leadership was textbook risk on, right? Momentum, growth, high beta, most shorted names, retail favorites, all ripped. Semis, memory, large cap banks, investment banks, airlines, defensives, copper were among the standouts as well. Energy, the notable laggard, with WTI crude settling down 1.5, kind of trailed the market as well. On the data front, pretty mixed. And frankly, secondary to the geopolitical story, you had consumer confidence beat expectations with the labor market views essentially unchanged. JOLTS job openings came in roughly in line at 6.88 million, and Chicago PMI missed. Treasuries are mostly firmer, with yields down about 3 basis points at the front end. The dollar fell 0.6%. Gold rallied 2.7%. And silver surged over 6%, while Bitcoin added nearly 2% on the day. Tomorrow brings ADP private payrolls, ISM manufacturing and retail sales in the morning, with the market closing Thursday afternoon ahead of the Good Friday holiday, which does mean we will have a best of show on Friday. The March employment report drops Friday morning in spite of the market being closed. Wall Street's looking for a 60,000 gain after February's negative 92,000 number. Why don't we hit the InvestTalk YouTube comment section question bank early today for a relatively fresh question that came in on ticker CAG. And that question says, your thoughts on a company like CAG that produces cheap food for times like these. Value trap or decent value at this price? I know the 9% dividend will likely be cut, but I've been nibbling under $16. All right, let's take a look if we think we should be nibbling as well. CAG is Conagra Brands. They sell processed and packaged foods. They have a grocery segment. They have the refrigerated and frozen segment. They have their international segment, and they have their food service segment as well. Now, 91% of their revenue, about 91% comes from the United States. Chart looks very weak, down 41.06% over the past 52 weeks. Beta has actually been flat, like nearly zero, negative 0.01 over the past year, which is kind of wild. Year-to-date change is about 9.19% negative. And growth is abysmal, to put it mildly. They have less revenue, rather they're projecting less revenue in May 2027 than they had in May 2021. Revenue growth is 1% from 2021 onward. Margins, a bit better than you'd expect for a company such as this. But I mean, the market's pricing it really weak relative to forward-looking earnings. 8.9 times price to forward-looking earnings, 0.9 book value. It is trading at less than the book value of its assets. It's trading at its lowest level in the past 5 years. And EBITDA margin stands at 17.6%, set to compress down to 15.2. I mean, margins across the board here are compressing down all the way from top to the bottom. Return on equity set to be at 9.9%. And not to mention dividend yield, 8.9% dividend yield. Compare that to the previous years. Oh, by the way, they didn't even pay a dividend in 2025. Compare that to the previous years where it was ranging from 2.7 to 5. All over the place. Absolutely all over the place. And so from a fundamental perspective, you know, it's got $6.4 billion in debt on a $7.5 billion market cap company. It's levered. Margins are compressing. Growth is, for lack of a better word, non-existent. And so what do I think about a company such as this? Well, you've been nibbling under 16. It shows no signs of improving. It's been on a persistent downtrend since the end of 2022, and revenue set to drop. I think overall, not a big fan here. I think there's a reason why it's been trailing such as it is, not just the market, but its industry writ large. And so when you ask me, you know, in a time such as these, where people try to trade down, they try to trade down into more budget options because things are getting a bit more expensive. I mean, I didn't really see a lot of growth from 2021 into 2022. They had $1 billion in revenue growth. It was under 10% at a time you'd expect for it to be fantastic. And then it just tapered off from there. So overall, I'm not really liking it. And oh, by the way, they report earnings tomorrow. So I certainly wouldn't be buying in before that happens either. That is CAG, Conagra Brands Incorporated. Thanks for watching. Thanks for leaving your question in the comment section. Now, we are well into the thick of it when it comes to the InvestTalk Market Madness. And if you don't own it by now, if you were a participant in this competition, or maybe if you weren't a participant in this competition, Justin and I are putting up videos on our InvestTalk YouTube channel where we are rounding out, I guess, each round of competition, talking about the winners, talking about the losers, what is driving returns, showing beautiful charts that I made if you're interested. And so that all happens exclusively on the InvestTalk YouTube channel. I want to remind you, if you are the winner, if you are eligible to win the $1,000 prize, That prize actually is 50% higher if you are a YouTube subscriber. So head over to Invest Talk with two T's over there on YouTube and check it out. We're headed into a break, a little bit longer than our last one. But when we come back, we'll talk about our main focus point about value versus growth. And of course, answer more of your finance and investment questions here on Invest Talk.
In the early days, Invest Talk was Jerry Klein and Steve Peasley. Now the torch has been passed and a new generation of hosts is on the job. Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero. So when you've got finance and investment questions, don't forget to call Invest Talk. 888-99-CHART.
So here's the number that really captures the story of Q1 2026. The Russell 1000 Growth Index is down nearly 5% year to date. The Russell 1000 Value Index, it's up 8.6. That's a spread of almost 14 percentage points. For context, the last two times we saw value outperform growth by this margin over a similar time frame were during the dot-com bust in 2001 and the bear market rout in 2022. We are living through what could be a genuine regime change in market leadership. The S&P 500 is on track for its biggest monthly decline in years, but the headline index is masking a much more complex picture underneath. Energy is up almost 21% year to date, materials 17, consumer staples 15, industrials 12. These sectors are at multi-year highs. Meanwhile, technology is the worst performing sector. IT is down, communication services down, Mag 7 have collectively plunged nearly 6%. Just in the month of March alone before rallying today. The Great Rotation, what analysts are calling silicon to steel, could be the defining story of the market right now. So the first question listeners are understandably asking, why are tech stocks falling when they're not directly affected by energy prices? And it's a fair question. Last time I checked, Microsoft does not drill oil. Apple doesn't ship crude through the Strait of Hormuz. But tech stocks are being hit by three forces simultaneously, and none of them are about oil directly. First, rising interest rates. This is the most important channel. When treasury yields rise, and they've jumped significantly since the Iran war started, the discount rate used to value future cash flows goes up. Tech companies are priced on the promise of earnings years into the future. When you raise the discount rate on these distant cash flows, present values drop. A stock priced at 40 times earnings is mathematically far more sensitive to rate changes than one priced at 15. This is why high growth stocks get crushed when yields rise, even if their actual business isn't affected by oil prices. Second, the AI CapEx questions. Investors spent 2023 through 2025 rewarding companies for promising to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on AI. Now they're demanding proof of return. Microsoft spent $37.5 billion in a single quarter on infrastructure and its stock fell because margins compressed. Nvidia reported a blowout quarter. Stock dropped because the market is asking where the AI investment cycle has peaked. Software stocks got hammered when new AI tools threatened to displace their core products. The sentiment has shifted from AI will change everything to show me the money. Third, the rotation itself tends to be a bit self-reinforcing. As money flows out of tech and into energy, industrials, and defensives, tech sells deeper, which triggers more outflows, which deepens it further. We're now at a point where growth stocks are trading at a 21% discount to Morningstar's fair value estimates, a level that they've been at less than 5% of the time since 2011. That tells you the selling has been a bit indiscriminate in some cases. Now, what technology tends to be a bit most vulnerable to economic downturns? Software is the most exposed right now for two reasons. AI disruption is hitting hardest here. If AI agents can automate legal work, coding, customer service, data analysis, what happens to the companies that sell software for those tasks? Workday is down 25% year to date. Adobe, ServiceNow, down 12. Salesforce, 9. Second reason is software companies depend on enterprise spending decisions. They get delayed when CFOs are uncertain. A semiconductor company fills orders from data center buildouts that are already contracted. A software company needs a CFO to sign a new deal The CFO is looking at oil at 100, inflation reaccelerating, and a possible recession, and deciding, oof, not going to do that now. So how should investors approach tech stocks during periods of macro uncertainty? Well, the practical answer depends on how you about your time horizon. If you're a long-term investor with 5 to 10 years, the sell-off's creating opportunities in high-quality names, names that are now trading at meaningful discounts to intrinsic value. Morningstar raised their fair value estimates on several hyperscalers, even as prices fell, because the underlying businesses are still growing. The AI build-out is real. Cloud adoption is real. Digital transformations are real. And so buying these companies at a discount to fair value because of a temporary oil shock is exactly the kind of opportunity somebody who has a long time horizon should be looking for. If you're a shorter term investor or you're overweight tech, this is a moment for rebalancing, not panic. The rotation from growth to value has been pretty rapid, but it's approaching oversold levels on a technical basis. So growth to values ratio is nearing some extremes that have historically preceded reversals. That doesn't mean tech is going to rip higher tomorrow, though it did today, but it does mean that easy money in the value trade may be largely made. Are current tech valuations justified given these changing economic environments? I mean, here's the tension. Growth stocks are expected to deliver 27% earnings growth this year versus 6.4% for value stocks. It's a massive gap. If these growth expectations hold, current valuations for many tech names are actually reasonable or even cheap after the sell-off. But if a recession materializes, or if the CapEx cycle slows, those growth estimates, they come down, then the multiples, they have further to fall. The bottom line is the Great Recession, Great Rotation, ooh, don't want to jinx it, is real. It's been violent, and it's created genuine opportunities on both sides of the market. Value stocks have earned their outperformance through legitimate earnings tailwinds from energy, defensives, and infrastructure. But the value trade is now crowded and technically extended. Tech stocks have been unfairly punished in some cases, but legitimately repriced in others. The smart approach isn't to pick a side, it's to rebalance towards those opportunities that the rotation has created. Still got a lot of show planned for you today, right when we come back from this break here on Invest Talk.
There are a few things that make KPP Financial special. One of them is parallel investing. This means they invest right alongside their clients. Here's how it works. When KPP Financial makes a trade for their clients, Justin Klein makes the same trade for himself and KPP on the same day, at the same price, and same percentage. No front running, no special treatment. Learn more about parallel investing at investtalk.com.
Hi, good day, Justin and Luke. This is Matt from Minneapolis. Long time listener here to your wonderful show. Hey, I appreciate everything you guys do. I have just a quick question for you. I've had the stock in my portfolio here, HPE, Hewlett Packard Enterprises, for quite some time. For the last year or so, it seems, it's just been in this range for me between like 18 and maybe 23. It hasn't broke out of that or done a thing. I'm getting tired of it, and I'm considering taking my money out and investing it someplace else. I hear you guys talking about value stocks a lot, and I found this fund, VTV. What do you think of that move, moving from HP to VTV? Would that be something positive for my future? Thank you for your answer. Look forward to hearing it on the show. Have a good day.
HPE is Hewlett Packard Enterprises. It is an enterprise IT infrastructure name. So think servers, storage, networking, and hybrid cloud. Now, they did report earnings on March 9th. Revenue was up about 18% year over year, a slight top line miss, but earnings per share was a record, beating the high end of guidance by about 10%. There was a recent acquisition of Juniper, which drove network revenue up about 152% year over year. Gross margins expanded sharply to 36.6%. Free cash flow was $708 million. And management raised full year EPS guidance to about $2.30 to $2.50. In spite of that, didn't jump much. It was trading at about $21 per share. Now it's trading about $23 per share. And one of the reasons why is because growth has been pretty stagnant year over year going back to 2020, to the point where it's trading at 8.9 times price to forward-looking earnings. I mean, it has been a frustrating hold. It ran from the high teens to 26 on the Juniper deal and AI infrastructure excitement, but then it drifted back to the low 20s as memory inflation and server weakness kind of started to dominate the narrative. Their networking margins hit about 23, 24%, and cumulative networks for AI orders were raised to about $1.7 billion. So the AI angle is real, but the market understandably is fixating a lot of the headwinds they've had. Now, the bull case is simple, right? A legitimate AI infrastructure play through Juniper's data center switching business, trading at roughly 9 times forward earnings, it's a steep discount to some of those pure play networking peers. But at the same time, the core server business is under a lot of pressure. Memory cost inflation is a huge deal. It will be a multi-quarter drag. And the Juniper integration added 2.6x net leverage to the balance sheet. So it's put in a bit of a weaker position at the time where the rest of the business is struggling. It is a $30 billion market cap company. It's got a decent amount of debt, about $20 billion now post-deal. And so with that frustration, maybe we want to diversify. Well, this would certainly be a bit of a wholesale shift, right? The thing about holding HPE, thing about selling it is it's fine. It's not exciting, right? Their server networking, hybrid cloud space is competitive. Margins are thin. Growth is modest. You're essentially swapping the single stock for your idea of the Vanguard Value ETF. Now, the Vanguard Value ETF, which is ticker VTV, it's a pretty large fund, right? They have about $162 billion under management. It's super cheap, 30 basis point expense ratio. Its top holdings are exactly who you'd expect them to be. Think your Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan, Exxon, Johnson & Johnson. It's done really well year to date. Compared to the rest of the market, it's up 1.64% year to date. And so with the shift that we just talked about, it gives you an instant diversification across sectors into something that has historically held up better than growth in recessionary high rate environments, which even if we resolve the issues in the Middle East tomorrow, the supply chain cost effects aren't going to be felt for quite some time, or aren't going to be gotten over for quite some time, which puts a lot of risk there. So I think that given the specific company you're trying to sell, I think it's probably a good idea. Moving into something like VTV, getting more value exposure, I think is a good idea as well. Thanks for the call. Let's keep things moving. Make it two in a row.
Hello. My question is regarding RCI Holdings, ticker RIC. I would like to know the prospects for a long-term hold. Is this still a worthwhile hold? And if it is it time to scoop more up? Would this be a good buy at these levels? Or is the thesis broken? Thank you, InvestTalk. Always giving the people what they want. I will hang up and listen.
RCI Hospitality. Well, if we are giving the people what they want, certainly RCI Hospitality is as well, because they operate adult nightclubs. They have a vast portfolio of restaurant, bar concepts, Bombshells, Cabaret, Tootsies, Scarlett's. They have about 40 plus nightclubs. And then their shrinking chain of that restaurant format. It has been a rough time for them. Over the past year, down 46.88%. Year to date, down 4.32%. And that's in spite of revenue growth being pretty solid over the past 5 years, but certainly bad over the past two, right? Their revenue was $293 billion in 2023. Now it's down to 279. Sorry, that is million, not billion. It has a $179 million market cap company that has $241 million in debt. They did turn a profit. They're just barely margin sitting at 3.9%. The stock has honestly been a bit demolished, right? Down roughly 50% over the past year. Now near its all-time lows, around 21 to 23 is where it has been ranging. And they really started with this leadership turnover. They had declining same-store sales. They had recurring impairment charges and self-insurance reserve charges all kind of hit at the same time. The bull case here is that the nightclubs are, well, a cash-generating business. They tend to do better in recessions than other businesses. They're high margins. They have loyal customer bases, limited competitions. And at roughly 5 to 6 times EBITDA, the stock is pretty cheap. Even if same-store sales are weak, if they stabilize, it becomes pretty cheap. Now, the downside here is their buyback program is being retired. Part of their business segment, specifically that Bombshell segment, is doing a real weak. It just looks to me to be a pretty deeply out of favor microcap name with a legitimate cash flowing business under a pile of one-time charges and leadership uncertainty that frankly puts it in a position where, especially given the access on the internet to, say, adult entertainment, seems to be a weak reason to invest in a business to the point where maybe the multiples here are justified. So this is a name we looked at one point in time. And for us, it was a pass then. For me, it's a pass. So we had two important data releases today, and both really paint a picture of a labor market that is softer than the headline unemployment rate really is suggesting. So let's start with the JOLTS jobs reports, where job openings fell by about 358,000 in February to 6.88 million, a bit below expectations. The job openings rate dropped to 4.2% from 4.4%. But the really concerning number is hiring. Hiring plunged by nearly 500,000 to 4.85 million, the lowest level since March of 2020, when the pandemic, as you all remember, shut down the entire economy. And so outside of COVID, it was the lowest since August 2014. That's a pretty stark number. Businesses aren't just being cautious about adding workers. They're essentially stopped adding workers. A decline in hiring, it was pretty broad. Accommodation and food services saw $178,000 opening drop. Healthcare, professional services, construction fell sharply, aligning with the weakness that we saw in this February payrolls report. And the decline in job openings were concentrated among small and mid-sized businesses, which are typically the most sensitive to economic uncertainty. Now, layoffs, they did tick up slightly, rising about 61,000 to 1.72 million, but remain pretty low in absolute terms. This is the low hire, low fire equilibrium that we've been talking about on the show. Companies aren't really cutting workers, but they've completely stopped bringing new ones in. Morgan Stanley's chief economist actually described it pretty well. He said the four horsemen of the labor market, which are hiring, layoffs, job openings, and unemployment rates, are all suggesting deterioration even before the oil shock fully works through the economy. Now, the Fed chair called this a zero employment growth equilibrium with a feel of downside risk. The phrase matters because it signals the Fed sees the labor market as fragile, even if the unemployment rate at 4.4 doesn't look alarming on its own. On the consumer side, the Conference Board's confidence index ticked up slightly to about 91, 92, above the 88 that economists expected. But internals tell a bit of a darker story. Consumers' 12-month inflation expectation jumped to 5.2%, the highest level since May of 2025. The proportion of people saying jobs are hard to get hit its highest level since February of 2021, and plans to buy big-ticket items, homes, cars, appliances, they shifted from yes and maybe to no. Conference Board's chief economist noted the cost of living remained at the top of consumers' minds, driven by tariff pass-through and spiking gas prices. Certainly that's on top of my mind. Labor market differential, which tracks the gap between people saying jobs are plentiful versus hard to get and correlates with the unemployment rate, has collapsed from 18.2 a year ago to about 5.8 today. There's a dramatic deterioration in how people perceive the job market, even if the headline numbers aren't caught up yet. So for investors, the data reinforces this bind, this stagflation bind that the Fed is trapped in. The labor market is weakening, which normally calls for rate cuts, but inflation expectations are on the rise, which prevents cuts. The Fed held rate hikes at 3.5 to 3.75 this month and projected only a single cut this year. But some economists now think that even that single cut may not happen. The window is closing because every week oil stays elevated. Inflation expectations are going to drift higher and the case for easing gets harder to make. Meanwhile, the real economy, the one where actual people are trying to find jobs and buy groceries, it's kind of getting squeezed from both sides. It's like we got plenty of time before our next break to tackle another one of your questions, this one on ticker SLB. It says, I own SLB, and the position is 4.3% of my portfolio. I'm up 24% and was wondering if I should take some profits at these new highs. Should we be taking profits on our energy stocks even when they hit new highs and the position grows above four-ish? I've heard the drop in energy will come quick. Well, SLB is Schlumberger. It is the world's largest oil field services company. So they do drilling, they do reservoir performance, they do production systems. And they have a bit of a fast-growing digital AI segment as well that has expanded into this data center cooling solutions business. Now, year-to-date, it is up 33.9%, up 22.94% over the past 52 weeks, which makes it now a $77 billion market cap company with only $9 billion in debt. As expected, oil prices go up, they do well. Oil prices go down, they do not do as well. Now for 2026, management guided revenue at about $37 to $38 billion, adjusted EBITDA about $8.6 to $9.1 billion, and CapEx about $2.5 billion. Now the catch, on March 11th, SLB pre-announced a Q1 2026 headwind of about 6 to 9 cents in EPS from additional costs, likely Mideast activity disruptions and seasonality, and said Q1 revenue would be a bit below expectations. Now, the stock previously peaked in 2024 at about $50 per share, then slid to the high 30s as oil prices begin to weaken and the oil field services cycle started to turn. But I mean, it's recovered a lot, right? Q1 has done very well for this company at $51.39 is where it's trading now. So on the plus side, you have this idea that SLB is quietly becoming a technology company inside of an oil services wrapper. It has $1 billion+ in digital ARR. Data center cooling exposure is growing 121%. And AI-driven workflow tools being adopted across the industry is certainly a positive for them at roughly a, what's their EV to EBITDA? 12? It's a bit higher than it has been until this recent run-up. It's still reasonable, 17.5 times price to forward-looking earnings. That's still in its average range. I mean, it is, even without the AI part, it is a best-in-class oil services name at a what was a cyclically depressed valuation before Mideast tensions and the rise in oil prices, with a bit of an interesting digital growth engine that maybe the market is underpricing a bit. So if oil stabilizes for a longer period of time, it could certainly be good for this business. What does that mean for their data center business? Stands to be seen. I would say that it's always a good idea to take profits, especially if you're significantly up, right? You can reallocate towards other areas of your portfolio. 4.3% isn't an egregiously high thing, but the idea is when you enter a position, you should have an idea of what your target is, what your tolerance band is for going above or below that, and then stick to that with discipline. That applies not just to this name, that applies to any single name in your portfolio. This is InvestTalk. I'm Luke Guerrero. We have one goal here: to help you achieve your financial freedom. Our work continues after this break, which will be our final break of this beautiful Tuesday. So get your questions in now by picking up that phone and dialing 888-99-CHART. Orlando from San Bernardino, hang on, you will be next.
Rain or shine, there's always value in the InvestTalk podcast. 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to Orlando from San Bernardino. How can I help you?
Hey. Hi, Luke. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Well, I have a question about some kind of opportunity cost.
Okay.
So I work for Leggett & Platt, and they're closing some plants down. They're closing the one here in Ontario, California, and I'm actually wondering, they offered me a stay pay bonus, but I'm thinking about opportunity costs. What if I can find a job that pays, you know, equal or more in the time? Whereas if I was to wait until the day that they close the plant, What if there's no work available then?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me ask you some clarifying questions here just to help me think through this. So what is the time period over which they want you to continue working?
I have until August 28th.
Okay, so they want to pay you...
6 months from when they told us.
So they want to pay you a bonus to continue working for the next 6 months?
Yeah.
Okay. And so is that bonus going to be paid at the end of the period? Is it just going to be paid like salary? Is it paid up front? Then you're contractually obligated to work that period of time? How does it work?
At the end of the period, and it's not contractual. I can be let go if I commit a fireable offense.
Okay, so it sounds like at the end of the period, there's an option that you would you move to a different plant, or how would that work?
I'm actually looking to move to a different company. I don't want to work for a company that's closing plants down.
Yeah, that's entirely fair. I mean, I don't see any downside, if I'm being honest, to continue to work for this company for the next 5 months while searching for another job. What is the job? The core question here is, right, you want stability. You want stability and income. Yeah. And for me, even if you're earning less at a new job, but it is for a longer period of time, i.e. you have a job in 12 months, it wouldn't be worth it to stay where you are just because there may be a higher bonus right now. Now, if you don't have a job lined up right now, or the job market is likely to continue to be good in the next 5 months, or you could negotiate with a company you wanted to work for that, hey, I would like to start at the end of this period in August for this reason, that could certainly be, you know, to your benefit. One other thing that could possibly happen as well is you could find a new job at a different company and say, hey, you know, I can't start until August because I'm going to be paid out this bonus. I'd be walking away from this, and that's just not something that I can financially do. And maybe they would be willing to pay you out that kind of thing as a bit of a starting bonus there. So my advice would be, in this particular situation, you need to get a little bit more clarity on what the job market looks like to you, how likely you are to get a new job immediately, which I think is preferable to a short-term bonus situation. And if you can even push that start date out further so you can kind of take advantage of the best of both worlds. Does that make sense?
Sweet. Yeah, it does. I had never thought of anything like that. I didn't think they would even consider that.
Yeah, it's always good to ask because you know what? The worst thing they can say is no.
Yeah, you're right. That's what I tell people too. Well, thank you, Luke.
Of course. Have a wonderful day, Orlando. Let's talk a little bit about gold. We don't have much time, but I think a lot of people have been interested to, if not puzzled by the fact that gold was supposed to be the ultimate crisis hedge. It's up over 200% so far this decade. It rallied during Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It rallied during previous Iran-related oil shocks. And yet, since the Iran war began, it's plunged. It's done worse than equities. So what kind of hedge is this anyway? Well, yields are rising, right? We talk about this all the time. Gold doesn't pay interest. There's an opportunity cost to holding on to something that does not have any yield. So if inflation expectations are meaningfully higher going into the future, gold prices are likely to fall. Central banks also seem to be selling it, which is an interesting newer dynamic. Turkey has sold $8 billion in gold. Poland's central bank governor recently mused about locking in profits from gold as well. And there's a bit of a structural concern. Gold has started behaving like a speculative asset rather than a safe haven. I like to chalk it up to, well, there's a lot of nuance, certainly. There's a lot of multiple things that are happening at once. But it really comes down to the core thing for me, which is when you're worried about a crisis in the future, you buy gold. When you're worried about a crisis today, you sell gold because you can't pay for your phone bill in gold. You pay in dollars. Well, guys, that does it for another episode of Invest Talk. Justin and I want to thank you for listening and encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads, which you can get at iTunes and Spotify, as well as our free videos, which you can get on the Invest Talk YouTube channel. As always, if today's show made you think about your investment, your retirement, your taxes, your kids' future, your future, whether everything is really within the plan for your goals, at KPP Financial, we offer no-cost portfolio reviews. It's a free and confidential service where Justin and I can just serve as another set of eyes just to give you a bit of a financial checkup. If that sounds interesting, head over to investtalk.com and click on the portfolio review button. We can't wait to speak with you. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.